Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Associate Director of Communications here at the radios. My name is Martin Zvonners. And at this point, I'd like to ask Barak Hoffman, the Executive Director of Georgetown University's Center for Democracy and Civil Society, to come and introduce our panel.
Thank you. My name is Barak Hoffman, Director of the Center for Democracy and Civil Society at Georgetown University. I want to thank Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty for co-hosting this event with us, and especially Ari Goldberg and Martin Zvonners. Also want to thank Melinda Herring, who's now taking pictures, for bringing this important issue to our attention, doing a lot of the hard work to put this event together. I think it's safe to say that no government likes to report bad news, and in the hierarchy of bad news on the economy, probably sits near the apex. At the same time, among the most difficult news to hide is news about the economy because it affects people in their daily lives. These difficulties are probably compounded in a country like Russia, where the government often justifies its autocratic political control on its ability to manage the economy effectively. To discuss these issues, we have put together a panel of experts on the Russian media, and David Satter will be introducing them briefly. David Satter is a longtime observer of Russia and the former Soviet Union, former correspondent in Moscow for the Financial Times, and has written extensively in the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. He is the author of two books, Age of Delirium, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union, and Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State, and he is now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. David, let me turn the event over to you.
Hey, thank you, Barak. I'd like to introduce the panelists. The first person to speak will be Dmitry Sidorov, the Washington Bureau Chief for Kommersant. He'll be followed by Daniel Kimmage, who's an independent consultant, formerly with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Andrei Sitov, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Russian news agency, Itar Tass, and from Prague, Brian Whitmore. So, Dmitry, perhaps you can begin, and we will take it from there.
Good morning. I'm honored to be here, and would like to thank...
Do you want to use that?
I don't know.
Can you hear me? Okay. I would like to thank...
Wait, I think they'll hear you a lot better if we turn it on.
Okay.
No, turn it off.
It's on.
It is on. Okay, wonderful. All right.
So I would like to thank Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, for inviting me here. I'm convinced that... there's no puzzle to crack discussing today the subject of today's conference, and it's not a new computer game or of an unknown shape or form where one should spend hours trying to figure it out. I think that no matter how hard the Kremlin is trying to make the world use what they call the sovereign democracy line created by ideologues behind the Red Wall, in reality, it comes to the old but thriving in Russia vertical of power game and style of governance. I think that it's a very well-known political game played by dictatorships of different forms, be it North Korea, be it Cuba, be it Saudi Arabia, be it other Arab countries, be it Russia. I will argue that the system created in Russia in reality should be called dictatorship, and we should stay away from such word as an authoritarian regime, no matter how carefully some in Washington are trying to juggle with words. Now, I think that the media in Russia is free only when the Kremlin allows it to be free. I will actually restrain myself from talking about the major Russian TV networks, such as the ORT, Channel 1, the RTR, Channel 2, and the MTV, Channel 4, for two reasons.
A little bit louder.
Okay, for two reasons. First, to state that the freedom of speech does exist in Russia in general, and crisis-wise in particular, is as far from the truth as to seriously persuade somebody that the Europeans didn't freeze their behinds off in January of 2008 or 2009 during the Russian-Ukrainian gas wars. The second thing is Dan Kimmage will dissect the nightmarish Russian TV coverage much better than I do. Now, I would like to pay attention to something you probably wouldn't expect from me, and this is the Echo of Moscow radio station for a second. Echo of Moscow is considered a beacon of democracy and free speech in Russia, and I was with those people who think so till January of 2009. Now, is this radio station free to criticize the government and tell the truth about severe financial crisis in the country? I think so, but to the certain point. However, we should not forget two very important things. Number one, the EOM, meaning the Echo of Moscow, Moscow's major shareholder is Gazprom. The Russian gas monopolist, as we all know, very dear to the Kremlin. Its control over the station policy became soundful in January this year during the gas war between Russia and Ukraine. It's interesting that responding to this conflict, commenting on this conflict, the editor-in-chief of the Echo of Moscow, Mr. Alexei Venediktov, felt free enough, rather, to mimic Ukrainian accent while on the air. And there was nobody in the studio to confront him. In my view, he was following the Gazprom orders, and if not, he should be even more ashamed of himself. Now, the second point is the Kremlin allows Echo of Moscow to be free mainly to rebuff the Western media argument pointing to absence of freedom of speech in Russia. By the way, we still do not know the content of the sample CDs and DVDs Mr. Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, passed to Condi Rice a couple of years ago to prove that vampires do exist or that freedom of speech is flourishing in the land of Putin and Medvedev. Nevertheless, I think that the Echo of Moscow broadcasts were, among others, included into those CDs or DVDs. Now, I will provide you with a few examples from the Russian print media and the war agencies to paint a picture. The first quote is, "The government measures allowed the country to escape the shock of the crisis. We did not allow the crushing devaluation of ruble," announced Vladimir Putin on February 5, 2008. Moreover, the Russian PM insisted again that the ruble may become the world's reserve currency. Most of the media dispersed the news without any objective analysis whatsoever, despite the fact that the Russian currency lost close to 40% of the value. 9 days later, on February 14, Alexei Kudrin, who just recently was in Washington, and as far as I remember was subpoenaed, but left the country last Sunday. So Alexei Kudrin made another statement while interviewed by the Russia TV channel. The Russia TV channel is the government RTR TV channel. "I think the process of ruble devaluation is a tough medicine to swallow, but it had a positive influence on the state of economy. It means that now money will reappear on the market and liquidity will be resurrected." On February 17, the Russian stock market collapsed, proving otherwise. Trading on the RTS and the MISEC stock exchanges in Moscow was suspended for 1 hour. Now, the very same people made a couple of statements in March and April, also dispersed by the Russian program and media. Kudrin, March 25, "We surmounted collapse of the banking system. The government measures didn't allow major Russian banks to go bankrupt." Putin on April 6, during the annual cabinet report, as covered by the Russian media, "The main result of the implemented anti-crisis measures showed that we managed to avoid the worst-case scenario. The impact of the crisis was softened. Our economy proved its ability not only to survive but to develop in the new, less comfortable conditions. The danger of the banking system collapse is over. Again, no analysis from the Russian media whatsoever. I mean, pro-Kremlin media, we are talking about TV, we are talking about wire agencies, we are talking about major newspapers, except for a few. Now, and here is the Bloomberg report related to the comments of Putin and Kudrin. Russian banks' bad loans will quadruple to $70 billion this year, deepening the country's worst financial crisis since the government's 1998 debt default, a Bloomberg survey shows. One of the largest state-controlled VTB may become a candidate to lose its investment grade rating, which would mean dilution of for equity shareholders and depreciation for its bond, said a person who manages $220 million in Russian equities at Clarion Lu AG in Zurich. Now, this is tough news for the Kremlin to swallow and to disperse, I think. It shows, in my view, the whole situation related to crisis coverage shows that the Kremlin is a control freak that demands to see information confirming its weird thoughts related to each and every matter, be it the crisis or the missile defense or Obama's presidency. Let me give you one example. Americans are unable to barbecue decent steaks, and your sushi art dad told me a big Russian TV boss I bumped into a couple of days ago. By the way, he asked me to provide him with a list of five New York decent New York restaurants because he was planning to go there. So then he paused for a second, and he told me, I also don't like your missile defense system plan and President Obama. I asked him what he smoked in the morning, but got no response. So my former editor-in-chief, editor-in-chief of Kommersant, Andrei Vasily, a few years ago, produced an excellent line. The Kremlin needs to read something that doesn't reflect its own views. He responded to a question how Kommersant is able to run stories nobody else dared. Now the situation has changed, I think. It is extremely difficult to publish sensitive pieces, mainly due to the fact that nobody knows issues that may trigger rage of the Kremlin. Since there was a number of crisis coverage meetings in the Kremlin where the media wire outlets were explicitly told not to panic or not to publish controversial articles, very few managed to deal with that. Decent media outlets' behavior in the situation reminds me of a joke when Moses told the Jews we should learn to live underwater after a meeting with a very unhappy Almighty who told them that he will actually flood the earth. So what's left of the real Russian journalism mainly resides on the web. The web is relatively free due to a very small audience that it has, I mean, within the country. I personally prefer to read Gazeta.ru, and for those who speak Russian, I will refer you to the latest piece by Andrei Larionov, formerly Putin's economic advisor and now working at Cato. Responding to the last question of today's conference, what will be the consequences of the coverage of this particular coverage of the crisis in Russia? I should say the following. I don't see how this weak coverage, or I would argue no coverage at all, no objective coverage at all, will lead to change of the current regime or change of the current situation. I don't think there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dmitry. Our next speaker is Daniel Kimmich. Daniel, I understand you're going to make a PowerPoint.
No, actually. No. I decided to spare people the PowerPoint because of time limitations.
Okay. Well, please, go ahead then.
Okay, thanks. Let me start by thanking everyone for showing up here this morning. It's a double pleasure always for me to speak at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. So, and as I said, I will spare you the PowerPoint. I will try to be so vivid, however, and evocative that you will barely notice. Our stated topic is muzzled media and the financial crisis, and I'd like to rephrase this a little bit and start with a question, which is, how do people know what they know, and what happens when what they think they know starts to diverge from what they know they see? So hold that question in mind as I will try to sketch what I'm going to call here the information manipulation strategy of the Kremlin and how it fits into the overall strategy of political control in today's Russia. And one remark as preparation is that the 20th century really conditioned us, I think, to look for information control, because the 20th century provided so many examples of this. Totalitarian states that would supply the population with radios tuned to a single frequency. We all know many of these examples, and of course the institutional memory at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is a wonderful place to discuss this, because the organization was created to break through that information blockade. And the point I would like to start with is that that is really not how things work in today's Russia. I think that what we see is more of an information manipulation strategy. Let me try to sketch out how I think that works and what this means in light of the crisis. So let's begin with the actual structure of power in Russia, which is a fairly familiar system at this point. They hold elections. It's a sort of imitation of democracy. It's sometimes called managed democracy. I prefer the term decorative democracy. So the opposition isn't banned or driven completely out of the country, but it really it's relegated to a decorative and controlled role. And there's a range of mechanisms that the state deploys to keep any real political contests either at the margins or entirely underground. And major contests have predetermined outcomes. So, you know, Medvedev's election as president, no one either in Russia or outside had any doubts about this. And bear in mind here, this is not total control. This is not the party Congress unanimously electing the leader. It's not arithmetic. It's more calculus, where you just sort of need to get close enough to have a majority vote. And when I say majority, this has to be something like, you know, 70% or higher usually. Now, where does information fit into this? Information, I would say, I would divide into really sort of three categories in Russia. You have television, which is really the source for most people. And there you have very strong control, and you do have an official message. Then you have the press, and I'm going to say print press, although it's a little bit different today with the internet. And in the press, you have weaker control. You have multiple messages. Some are official. Some are non-official. And then finally, you have the internet, where there's the weakest control, where I would argue there's actually the greatest information manipulation and a great deal of white noise. So let me talk a little bit about the message and the mediums. Now, there is an official message, and if you have the time, I encourage you to sit down, and if you speak Russian, go through a week or so of news coverage on any of the major TV channels, and you'll get a sense of what the official message is. And the official message is what top officials say. It is the line. Now, the official message comes with an asterisk, because there's also a official subtext, and you find the official subtext also on state television. So the official message will be what President Medvedev says or Prime Minister Putin says, and the unofficial subtext will be what an approved commentator like Mikhail Leontief says. And I'll explain what these messages are. The difference is really in the audience. The official message is for a global audience. It's designed to sound as good in Washington as it does in Moscow. The unofficial subtext is really designed for a domestic audience and sounds quite strange when you listen to it in outside of Russia. So the official message is fairly simple. It is that American irresponsibility is the root cause of the crisis, and that's not such an unusual message. There are many here who would agree in Europe. And the other part of the official message is that the Russian government is working successfully and tirelessly to overcome the crisis. Now, the official subtext is that the crisis is a vast defeat for America and a potential victory for Russia in a rather conspiratorial worldview that I can go into detail on in the question and answer, but that's the official subtext. Now, when it comes to television, in terms of conveying this message, I'm just going to give you a very quick quote from a paper presented at the 10th International Conference of Economic and Society Problems in Development in Moscow in early April. And it's a very simple quote. It says that there's a sort of dual character to television coverage of anti-crisis measures. On the one hand, the leaders are shown to be active and in control, and they're taking measures. On the other hand, there is absolutely no critical reflection on how these decisions are made. And I think that's a very accurate characterization. So if you go through coverage on the Russian state television channels, you find very brisk official actions to mitigate the effects of the crisis, a lot about subsidies, measures to help the population, quite little on why the population actually requires so much help. You don't find a lot about hardship. Now, let me give you the subtext that accompanies this message. If we look at the April 23rd commentary by Mikhail Leontief on the suicide of the Freddie Mac CFO here in the Washington area, David Kellerman, he describes it as potentially more significant than the assassination of President Kennedy and suggests that dark forces are at work in the U.S. to hide the causes, the true causes of the financial crisis. In late January, he described America as a parasite that feeds off the global system, building its success on the sufferings of other countries, and he reaches back in a fairly characteristic move for the Kremlin ideology and says that America's post-war success was built, he said, paid for with our blood and our gold. This is the unofficial subtext. Okay, so that's television. Let me talk a little bit about newspapers. In large circulation newspapers, you get a lot of approving coverage of anti-crisis measures, some occasional details on hardships. Smaller circulation newspapers provide some very critical coverage sometimes, Novaya Gazeta, the New Times. The one thing you tend not to find is investigative coverage that touches on the financial interests of the elite. That's generally off limits. On the internet, you find a real variety of voices. You can find absolutely everything. What is interesting is how civil society speaks on the internet. Civil society on the internet in Russia often tends to take the form of quasi-official bodies. So you'll find the youth wing of United Russia Party. If you go to their website, in the very front page, you find, interestingly, a link to this unofficial subtext, this conspiratorial and generally anti-American message that the crisis will wreck America. If you go to the United Russia website, the ruling party, you find an analytical article, Days Remain Before the Bankruptcy of America. If you go to a financial website that's quite pro-Kremlin, you find Slaves of the Dollar Led to the Slaughter. If you go into the fringes of the internet, you can find things like a new article that came out yesterday describing swine flu as a viral act of terror perpetrated perhaps by the American government to deflect attention from the crisis and allow them to kill off some of their own people and test the effectiveness of some of their biological terror things. What's interesting is that when a kooky article like this comes out, there's actually quite a mechanism to move it out to blogs and all sorts of other media. Now, the bottom line here, I would say, is that what we see is actually an inverted structure of how media should operate. There are revelations, there is criticism, but it doesn't resonate. There's really no mechanism for it to influence the political elite. You don't have the function of a free press in a free society where it interacts with civil society and government, it illuminates the situation, it triggers action, provides communication between rulers and ruled, and it actually influences the political elite. Mainly what you see in Russia is a top-down message bifurcated into two parts, disseminated through various means. It's not that there isn't another message, it's that that other message is entirely cut out of the political process. There's no way for it to really cause any effect. And so the question I would ask, I would just end with two questions, going back to this initial question I started with. The first is, I'm just curious, I don't have an answer to this. What is the effect of this very dubious and strange brew of conspiracy theories that runs through the information field? I don't know that anyone's done any work on this. I'm quite curious to see how this is affecting actual views in Russia. And second, and probably more important, the most important question is, what happens as the gap between reality on the ground and official messages that come from the top grows wider? How effective will this model be if the crisis continues or if it worsens? This model, I think, was quite effective under conditions of relative prosperity. There are some indications that it is no longer quite so effective, and I'm going to leave that as the final question and turn it over to my fellow panelists. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Daniel. And our next speaker is Andrei Sitov. And
Or what about Prague? Did you say?
Prague will follow.
Oh, okay.
So
very good. No, it's interesting because I I was thinking that a third voice would be probably better for my purposes, because I do have a feeling that I am sitting inside an echo chamber, and I could not really detect any difference in the tenor of the presentation between a Russian journalist and an American analyst, even though the Russian journalist at this point was more of an analyst, because he analyzed the reaction of the Russian media, which I cannot pretend to do. I'm a practicing journalist. I told the organizers of the event that I probably am not qualified to talk to you about the subject, because I've been in Washington, D.C. for the past 12 years, more than 12 years, and I have too much work, and I'm overworked and underpaid rather than muzzled. So, but I frankly believe that that is the situation with all the press. That is an unfortunate confluence of events where the Russian press and the American press and the world press is struggling for survival at a critical juncture, just because of the onset of the internet and the absence of a viable business model. I have a suspicion that some of our American colleagues are probably, I would not say envious that they are not at this point yet, but they probably look with interest at other people's models, such as the BBC, for instance, which, if I were to choose an information source for my own purposes, I use all sources, with the exception of the unreliable ones. But if I were to choose a source, I would probably choose the Brits. You know, the BBC, the Reuters, the Financial Times. I would probably not rely too much on the Americans, because of the same sort of the echo chamber effect. They are quite good on domestic issues. I agree with that, including the crisis issues. But in terms of international coverage, I would say there is this quote-unquote patriotic consensus, and I go to the White House almost daily to the briefings. I very rarely see it challenged. Maybe the only exception, the real exception, is the venerable Helen Thomas, who just, because of her age, I think, because of her age and the special status, she doesn't care about presidents. She's seen them on, seen them all, and she takes them on all the time. She's about the only one who cares to do that. It's not that the others can't do that. They can, but they don't care to do that, because it's my personal impression that the American press is not free from the public opinion, from the influence of the public opinion. They form and create the public opinion to a degree, but they are also influenced by it. And I think the situation is gradually moving in the same direction in Russia. That is where the echo effect is generated. Maybe some of it is generated by the government. I wouldn't argue with that. I don't know with that. I read the stories about meetings at the Kremlin where people were given instructions on how to do things. Basically, you don't need that here. One of my recent interesting pieces was, for a long time, I mean, in a way, it's nice to be in a Washington audience discussing this, because if I talk to a Russian audience about the Washington Post, for instance, they don't understand. They don't know how the Post covers Russia. You guys do. And I've been trying for years to get an answer why the editorial page of the Post is so hostile to, not only I would argue to the Russian government, but to Russia in general. And I finally spoke to, no, I didn't speak to her, she responded to my email questions, to the publisher. And she's a nice young lady, and Her response was, no, we don't have any bias. I don't see any bias. The editorial coverage does reflect the views of the publisher. She admitted that. She she sort of maybe was proud of that. But she doesn't see any bias, which is amazing to me. Because for me, it's a fact. I don't know. Except that, of course, what are facts? Facts are in our minds, in our perceptions. Like even here, to come back to the subject at hand, I was listening to Dmitry and his analysis of the situation, and I was thinking, we are listening here to a Russian reporter who writes for a major Russian daily. What better proof do you need to see that there are dissenting voices, that people can write very critical stuff, very unkind. I was looking for a word. I couldn't find a good word. Very unkind to the government. And if I look at the taboo subjects, which is a favorite query of mine, I collect taboos. Obviously, there are many more taboos in the Russian press than in the American ones. Even though I do know some taboos in the American press, which I define as subjects that are factually true but cannot be broached. They exist on both sides. They exist on both sides. Daniel, on the other hand, has done my job for me in a way. He has described, I think, very interestingly for me as a practicing journalist rather than an analyst. It was interesting to hear why he thinks we are seeing what we are seeing. I can only repeat that as far as I understand, for the Russian audience, the coverage of the current financial crisis boils down to, if we take the international aspect of it, to maybe two major points. Point number one being is that it's not our crisis. The origins, the roots of the crisis were not in our country. And I think it's just a fact of life, and it's been admitted many times by the American politicians, including President Obama, including at his press conference yesterday. Except that, of course, the American politicians and the American media do not place an emphasis on that for obvious reasons. For the Russians, it is a big source of interest and fear, and I would say resentment, because we all know how hard the economic history of the country was for the past, for the whole post-Soviet period, how the Soviets were, the former Soviets, were humiliated and put down by their dire economic need, which was there. And I had to read all this. I had to study all this because one of my bosses is so fond of talking to American politicians on television that he does documentaries and profiles all the time. And I have to read all those books. And one book I remember in this context is the Scowcroft Bush Senior book about their presidency, where I was struck by the admission that when the Soviet Union was collapsing, about the most prominent issue on the mind of the then President Bush was the issue of the Soviet debts. It was not like helping this crumbling structure. Probably the biggest priority, of course, was to make sure that there was no nuclear conflagration, no major crisis that would threaten the world as we know it. But other than that, the biggest issue was making sure the Soviets paid up, the former Soviets. And when the Russians assumed the debt, that was like his biggest issue resolved. Then, of course, came the funny period, and I say funny in inverted commas, when the Soviets came begging, the Russians came begging here for assistance to the IMF. And I had to cover all of that because there were no other people in the bureau willing to take this this task of covering financial issues. And I had to do it, and it was important. It is important now again, the financial coverage. I remember how, quote-unquote, funny it was to see a communist like Maslyukov when he became the head of government or the deputy head of government to come here and talk about macroeconomic indicators, which he probably had heard first about a few months ago. On the other hand, you know, maybe they knew all of that. I remember I was talking to a major functionary about Max Weber's books, which for me it's a continuing education, which is why I enjoy my job so much, which is why I enjoy talking to audiences like this so much. Max Weber was an early discovery for me here, and he said, "Yeah, we studied all that. The books had been translated. We knew all of that." But people show me signs that maybe I should wrap up my rambling, my rambling thoughts. Basically, the point: the crisis is an American crisis. We resent that because we lost much of the treasure that was put together with much effort under Putin and Kudrin. So thanks mostly to the Kudrin stance. Second, an important point bearing on the IMF and all of that, the IMF was giving the exact opposite in terms of recommendations at that point. They were advocating austerity when the Russians were in crisis. When the Americans are in crisis, all of a sudden it's stimulus. And when Kudrin, as Dmitry mentioned, Kudrin was here recently, and then the issue of subpoena is very interesting. I spoke to his lawyer, Kudrin's lawyer, yesterday. He gave interesting insights. But Kudrin said an interesting thing. We don't know what the result of this weak monetary policy, a fiscal policy, will be. That is, they are trying, the American government now is trying to put out the fire that was caused by this unlimited free money. With unlimited free money, this is, again, the argument that is made here. So I guess I should stop. Like, people cast glances at me.
Yeah, so we'll have the opportunity to continue the discussion.
But I enjoy it.
Yeah, well, you'll enjoy it even more, I think, when we have some questions and answers. But we have to get on to our fourth speaker, who is Brian Whitmore, who's joining us from Prague. Hello, Brian.
Hello, David. Good to see you.
Hi. Good to see you, even from a distance. Brian is a senior correspondent of Radio Liberty and former Moscow correspondent. So, Brian, will you take it from there?
Yeah, thank you, David. I want to thank everybody for coming. What I want to do is talk less about the media per se and kind of take a peek behind the curtain at the political context in which this is all happening and the kind of the political sparring that's going on around, among the Russian elite, which, by the way, is leaking into the media. It's finding its way onto the online media primarily and to the lower circulation newspapers and even to some of the higher circulation newspapers. It's not getting onto the television coverage. The television coverage gives you the impression that the Russian government is completely united and is battling the crisis successfully. What's going on in reality is the economic crisis inside the Russian authorities has become very politicized. The elite's deeply divided, and you have different factions that have learned very different lessons from this crisis, and not surprisingly, have come to different conclusions about what kind of prescriptions should be applied. For example, Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov and Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin see, if you can judge from what's been leaking into the online media, see the crisis as an opportunity to diversify the economy, to make it less dependent on energy, to have less prominence for these massive state corporations, these conglomerates. So they're basically arguing for a diversification. That's their lesson from the crisis. The crisis exposes the dangerous weakness that Russia has on commodities and commodities exports. On the other side of it is another Igor, another deputy prime minister, Igor Sechin, who's closely affiliated with is the informal leader of the Siloviki faction of former security service veterans that surround Putin. He not surprisingly, thinks the system is just needs to be made to work more effectively. Mr. Sechin, of course, is also the chairman of Rosneft, the largest oil company in Russia. This debate about economics, however, is also a debate about politics. Because diversifying an economy also implies decentralizing economic power. And when you decentralize economic power, you decentralize political power. And this would mean some kind of changes to the system of sovereign democracy or managed democracy or whatever it is we want to call it that we've had since Putin came to power in 2000. Technocrats like Kudrin, and I'm loath to call them liberals or Democrats or reformers, so let's just use the term technocrats. Technocrats like Kudrin and Shuvalov are comfortable with this. But Sechin and the Siloviki are not, and they've launched a series of attacks on Kudrin to try to remove him from his post as finance minister. Kudrin survived these. A lot of the speculation that I've been reading about it is because of his rather close personal relationship with Mr. Putin. Both served in the St. Petersburg city government in the 1990s. And rumor has it that Kudrin is the only official that's allowed to use the familiar T form with Putin when they speak in private. So this is the political context. Now, this whole narrative I just spelled out here, I got almost exclusively from the Russian media, although it's the online media. It's the media that's not available to everybody. You won't get this narrative if you're just watching Russian television, which I'm doing every day more than is probably healthy for me. So this narrative is out there, but you have to play connect the dots. You have to read multiple sources. And another thing I would would add here is that a lot of this stuff initially leaks through the foreign media. For example, Shuvalov's comments about diversification came out through the Financial Times and then were later picked up by the Russian media. But what's happening is when you have a political debate like this in Russia, things leak. And but you have to play detective and kind of put connect the dots and put the pieces together. I'm going to keep it very brief because I want to leave plenty of time for questions. So I'm going to stop at that and let it put it out for questions.